This podcast is brought to you by Workle, a platform helping people get happier at work. Find out more at workle.co. Work happier.
I kind of felt like I was a bit of a weirdo, I suppose. For a digital native like me, a Gen Z, it was impossible not to be fascinated by all these new technologies. For it was Facebook when I was a teenager, or Instagram, Snapchat, Uber, Deliveroo, you name it. I was obsessed with the tech world. You almost get stuck in this kind of schizophrenia where you don't feel completely at home with where you're going, but you also start to get dislocated from your roots.
Welcome to the Happy Work Life podcast, where people with inspiring careers reflect on how happy they have been in their working lives. On this podcast, we hear from a range of people working in business, startups, science, academia, media, healthcare, fashion, and much more, and find out which roles gave them the most satisfaction and, importantly, what they have done to get happier at work. So, sit down with me, Mark Price, founder of Workle, to help you get happier at work. Workle is the platform where you can find a job in the happiest companies, take our happiness test, network, and get career support from experts, and much, much more. On this edition of the Happy Work Life podcast, I'm delighted to be joined by Joe Seddon. Now, for those of you that don't know, Joe is a British technology entrepreneur known for founding the business Zero Gravity, a technology company that supports students from low opportunity areas into university and then into careers. In 2022, Joe was named in the Forbes 30 Under 30 list for his contribution to technology and entrepreneurship. And then a year later in 2023, he was honoured in the King Charles's Birthday Honours List. In 2024, the Sunday Times featured Joe in their inaugural Young Power List as one of the 25 most inspiring people aged under 30 in the UK and Ireland. Joe, welcome to the podcast. We're delighted to have you on the programme. And I'd like to start, if I can, by talking about your early years. You grew up in West Yorkshire and you grew up in Morley. So tell us a little about Morley and West Yorkshire and what that was like to grow up in.
Sure. So I was born in 1997 in Leeds General Infirmary. So born in Leeds, but grew up in Morley, which is a small post-industrial market town in West Yorkshire. They're fairly, I suppose, middle of the road place. And I grew up in a single parent background. My mum's a speech therapist in the NHS, and I'm brought up three pesky children, of which I was the eldest. And what I saw growing up was a lot of those barriers that prevent ambitious people living in sort of small towns across the UK from really getting on and unlocking their potential. Now, I was somebody who was ambitious, that had aspirations of being a tech entrepreneur. I was obsessed with all these new incredible innovations coming out of Silicon Valley, whether it was Facebook when I was a teenager, or Instagram, Snapchat, Uber, Deliveroo, you name it. I was obsessed with the tech world, but it felt like a million miles away from Morley in West Yorkshire. And when it came to actually progressing through the steps you need to go to break into a high-powered career in the tech space, or indeed any other career, I just faced a number of huge barriers, whether it was financial anxiety, growing up, not having the resources for tutors, for textbooks, for sort of fancy extracurriculars, or whether it was living in a town that was kind of geographically disconnected from opportunity. There was this crazy stat, which is in Wakefield, which is the closest sort of big town slash city to where I grew up. It takes longer to go on the bus from one side of Wakefield to the other than it does to go from Wakefield to London on the train. The transport connections in a lot of these towns are absolutely dire. And that sort of disconnects people from opportunity, because even if you've got a city nearby, actually getting there is another thing altogether. And that disconnects you from the universities, employers, work experience, you name it. So I saw these things growing up. And I went to a state school and I managed to get an offer to study PPE at Oxford University, which was a crazy thing for someone from my background to do. Indeed, in the year I graduated from Oxford, not a single person from the parliamentary constituency of Mullion Outwood got a place to study at Oxford University. So I had to be unorthodox. I had to defy the odds. But it made me think there must be thousands of other people like me. And when I graduate and I want to build something that really levels the playing field and makes it easier for the next generation so they don't have to jump over all of the hurdles that I had to go through.
So winding back then, you said that you had an interest in tech early on. Where did that come from? Were you mad on computer games, or I mean, what was it that made you think, oh, yeah, I really like tech, I'm interested in tech?
So I was definitely interested in video games growing up, as a lot of young boys in my generation were. I remember the first game I ever played was Tomb Raider on the PlayStation 1. I was sort of a Lara Croft obsessive back in the day. But I think the thing that really inspired me is I lived through a period where it was almost impossible not to have interaction with a number of new innovative tech products. So almost every facet of my life was being redefined by technology, whether it was kind of how you socialize with your friends, completely upended by Facebook, by WhatsApp, by Snapchat, whether it was things like access to information. Now, I remember living through the period of kind of dial-up internet to kind of Wi-Fi to then the smartphone, completely changing how you're able to access information. They went from having to sit down in front of a desktop computer to be able to access, you know, any facts you want in the world, you know, straight from your mobile phone. So I think for a digital native like me, a Gen Z, it was impossible not to be fascinated by all these new technologies. And I used to listen to these sort of Silicon Valley podcasts when I came back home from school. And it was almost like a little bit of a dirty secret because I wanted to immerse myself in technology and tech culture, but growing up in Morley in West Yorkshire, like that wasn't something that was necessarily encouraged or understood. Now, there was no local kind of tech community. Like even in West Yorkshire as a whole, there wasn't really any tech startup community at that point. It was all concentrated down in London. So I kind of kept this thing as a dirty secret from my friends that I was interested in this. When it only sort of was after university that I was able to properly pursue that. Beforehand, I sort of kept those ambitions under wrap because I wasn't sure if people would understand them. And I wasn't sure, to be honest, that I had the correct resources to actually attain them. So almost out of like not wanting to have social embarrassment, I sort of didn't tell my friends or family about those aspirations.
And when Joe, did you first have that thought, oh, I want to build a tech business? When can you is was there a moment when you thought, I want to do this?
Well, like many entrepreneurs, even though if you read about me online, I'd probably be characterized as a kind of overnight success. I did have a kind of number of sort of small failed sort of mini ventures before I launched the big thing, which was, you know, as a teenager, I used to like build websites for people. I sort of was a one man band agency, I suppose, and building websites about, you know, cake shops and all sorts of things. I used to build kind of internet communities for one of the video games I was interested in, which is a slightly nerdy game called Football Manager, which is still going today, I'm glad to say. So I had all these sort of small tech-driven projects I was doing, which from a financial point of view certainly weren't lucrative and they didn't necessarily achieve high scale. But what they did give me an understanding of was almost how to go from zero to something. Now, how to take an idea, get it off the ground, then build a product which you put into the hands of users, and then iterate and learn over time. So, like, I was doing these things, but I was scared to talk about them because I kind of felt like I was a bit of a weirdo, I suppose. Because in West Yorkshire in particular, I think there is not a culture which is necessarily conducive to entrepreneurship. Now, as the kind of joke goes, if you walk into a West Yorkshire pub and say you're an entrepreneur, people will assume you're unemployed. Like that's not seen as a kind of viable career path or lifestyle. It's almost just seen as an innuendo. And even the people in my network who I suppose loved me the most, had my best interests at heart, didn't want me to take an entrepreneurial path. You know, my mum encouraged me to kind of take the kind of classic corporate route, and that's what my friends thought was best for me as well. So the idea of being an entrepreneur in the culture in which I grew up was certainly not a normal thing or something that was encouraged. And I had to be incredibly kind of, I suppose, I had to be someone who was willing to kind of go against the norm and the constraint of the culture in which I grew up in order to do that. So almost a slight, not revolutionary mindset, but someone who was willing to kind of push past normal societal norms, I suppose.
And Joe, where did you learn to code? So if you were making websites for people when you were young and communities, you must have learned to code somewhere.
Unfortunately, I grew up just before all of these incredible online gamified platforms which teach you to code. So for me, it really was kind of HTML for dummies style textbook learning, which wasn't great because even though you could get a kind of intellectual understanding of coding from that, in terms of how to apply it and get stuff done, it was pretty tricky. But I was obsessed and I love to build things. I love the idea that you could sort of sit in your bedroom and build something on your computer, which would then be distributed into the hands of potentially millions of people. So kind of through trial and error over time, I kind of learned what you needed to get by and succeed. And I certainly wouldn't say I was some kind of advanced or super programmer. I was just somebody who kind of mastered the basics and enough to sort of get me off the ground. And nowadays, I don't do any coding whatsoever, and I haven't opened GitHub in years. But in terms of actually being able to build a product to sort of go from nothing to something, I think having that kind of toolkit is incredibly useful nowadays, where you can build a business from your bedroom in a way you just couldn't 20 years ago.
And in terms of school, you did really well academically at school. You got 12 A star A levels and or GCSEs, and then 4 A levels A star. So you did really well. And was there anything you did at school that kind of either helped you in terms of the entrepreneurial business journey or the tech journey?
I think entrepreneurship, as I mentioned, wasn't a kind of viable career path that was pushed at school. And I was someone who was academic and I was driven. I saw education as a kind of escape in many ways, which was if you were somebody who wanted to defy the odds, now I kind of had the belief that education was the best possible route for me to do something that was kind of dramatically different from what was expected for people from the area I came from. So I kind of went all in on that part of my life for my kind of latter years at school. And it was incredibly difficult though, because I saw firsthand that just how more tricky it is if you are somebody who doesn't have financial resources on tap. So like when it came to revising for my GCSEs and A levels, I didn't have any private tutors. For instance, I went to a state school, which was a good state school in West Yorkshire, but didn't have the kind of resources that many private schools have on tap. After school revision classes, kind of expert tutors, the extracurricular activities to expand your horizon before, beyond the curriculum. So I had to take a very self-driven, independent route. And what I kind of learned over time were just kind of the rules of the game and almost the cheat codes to allow me to get through this system that wasn't necessarily primed for people like me. So I almost became an expert in, guessing what exam questions would come up, learning the kind of curriculum, right down to the T. But I had to sort of do those things because I didn't have access to the same financial resources as other students.
And Joe, you're clearly driven. Why? Where'd you get that from? I mean, because as you said, you're kind of obsessive about revising for your exams and getting good grades. You were sitting in your bedroom making websites and doing whatever. Where does that come from?
It's difficult to say exactly where your kind of drive and purpose comes from. But for me, I think it was both a sense of light and darkness. So the lightness was I was brought up in a single parent family, and my mum was a kind of incredible mother figure. They gave me a really strong sense of values early doors. I think those kind of behaviors, even though I didn't necessarily have the same amount of financial resources of someone who went to a much more well-resourced school or lived in a leafier area, and I did have the kind of behaviors which I think stood the test of time and led me to be a kind of driven, independent, motivated person. But I think the dark side of that is also, to be honest, growing up in a single parent family, and I did have a lot of trauma, I suppose, from my childhood, no various things that happened, no sense of vulnerability. Like it wasn't always the kind of most stable environment. And I think that almost darkness did create a sense of vulnerability and escape within me, in terms of I wanted to take full control of my destiny and not feel subject to the kind of control of others. And there's lots of research online that shows that people from single parent families are actually overrepresented in a lot of professions, which do require a huge degree of drive and resilience. And to be honest, I think the reason for that does often stem from the darkness of trauma than the lightness of good value. So I think there was a bit of that, to be honest, as well.
And a sort of a similar question, but from a slightly different angle. You mentioned that you're the only person from your area, I think you said constituency, that went to Oxbridge. So how were you able to break out? How did you do it?
Yeah, so in the year I graduated from Oxford, not a single person from the parliamentary constituency of Morley & Outwood got a place at the university. So when you think that there's sort of 650 constituencies in the UK and each one's got around 100,000 people in it, that's pretty dramatic, especially when you look at a lot of constituencies in London and the South East, where there's literally, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of people going every year. So it definitely wasn't a expectation for someone from my local area to do that. And indeed, it kind of came with all these problems of identity as well. Now, imposter syndrome is something that is well spoken about. And that's something, certainly something I faced as well as I transitioned from Morley to the Dreaming Spires of Oxford. But I think what's often not explored is what I call social mobility guilt, which is leaving my hometown and my roots to move not just to a different area, but to a different kind of network where I'm surrounded by people from very different backgrounds, also dislocated me from the people I grew up with. And that, in many ways, I think, is even more difficult to navigate than imposter syndrome, because a lot of the people you grew up with, whether it's your parents or your friends, don't necessarily understand that new world you're stepping into. And sometimes can have a degree of almost like skepticism about it. So I remember when I told people I was going to Oxford, the people were kind of happy, they thought it was a great achievement, but people thought, oh, you're going to go and spend time with the poshos, you know, why do you want to, you know, go be with the Bullingdon boys? Like, what's wrong with Yorkshire? Is it not good enough for you? And that is an experience I think a lot of people from socially mobile backgrounds go through, where there is a lot of guilt that accrues as a result of leaving your area. So you almost get stuck in this kind of schizophrenia where you don't feel completely at home with where you're going, but you also start to get dislocated from your roots as well. So you're in a kind of weird abyss in the middle. And that was something that was certainly difficult to navigate. So I think those issues of identity are almost as important as the kind of more tangible issues around, you know, how good's your school, financial resources, access to opportunity, because it's those issues of identity and culture which shape people's ambitions and their willingness to actually take a chance or a bet in the first place. And I think one of the reasons I got into Oxford was I actually gave it a go and I applied, which was certainly not something that was on my radar or that many other people did. Like, I'm sure there was so many people from my school and local area who had the academic aptitudes to get into Oxford, but I think because of some of those cultural reasons I refer to, they just never even gave it a go in the first place.
And who encouraged you to apply, Joe?
It's quite a arbitrary story, actually, which is, you know, when I got those GCSE results, my school put me forward for an interview on BBC Radio Leeds. So I was one of those sort of nervous students on results day opening their results on live radio. And as you mentioned, I got a good set of grades, and the interviewer asked me, you know, are you going to give Oxbridge a go? How do you feel about that? Being someone who goes to a kind of state school in West Yorkshire, do you think you've got a chance? And I was completely flummoxed because the idea of applying to Oxbridge had never even sort of passed my mind before as something that was possible for someone like me. And from that completely kind of chance interaction, that planted the seed that actually made me think over the next couple of years, then maybe I should give this a go. And maybe I do have what it takes. But literally, had that not happened, I think I probably never would have applied because the environment in which I was situated in was not an environment where Oxbridge was an ambition that was pushed or an ambition that was seen as possible by people from a small town in West Yorkshire like I grew up in.
And then tell us about the experience of actually going for an interview at Oxbridge and how that felt and what happened from there.
So there's a lot of mystery around the Oxford interview process. And if you are somebody from a background where it's not the norm to apply, then there is a huge amount of imposter syndrome when you turn up at those universities for the first time. And I was just a nervous wreck, in all honesty. And I was someone who was academically confident when it came to my work at school. But when it came to stepping into this completely new environment where I had no idea what to expect, I just felt I didn't have the kind of mental toolkit to deal with that. So I remember going into my first Oxford interview and sort of facing a couple of these world-leading academics. And they were just asking me to do basic things at the beginning of my interview. But I was struggling even to do the basics because I was so kind of overawed at this environment I was stepping into. Like, not just the grandeur of the architecture, but also just the kind of melting pot of the interview as well, where you're surrounded by candidates from all four corners of the country, many of them from a kind of much higher social class than what I grew up in. And I think the other thing that makes it tricky as well is the interviews are very, to use an academic word, like dialectical. It's kind of back and forth, intellectual jousting style discussion. And I think that works really well to get an understanding of someone's thought process. If they are from a background where that kind of way of communicating is the norm. So if you've grown up in a family with two professional parents and you go to a really good school, that kind of dining table style conversation debate is very normalized. We've been doing that probably since the age of 5 or 6. But I wasn't used to that kind of dialectical style going back and forth because now I wasn't having those sort of conversations at school or at home a lot of the time. So I did find it a struggle, and being able to articulate your thinking process, your thought process, even though that's something that comes naturally to me now, when I was a 17-year-old, that was very difficult to tease out. So I think often these interview processes, which can look on the outside to be kind of unbiased and meritocratic, actually usually are based on a certain set of assumptions that do skew towards the kind of type of candidates who have historically been at the university. And I saw certainly felt that when I went through it myself.
And then when you were offered a place, were you surprised?
Yeah, I was surprised. It was a huge shock. I remember sort of opening the letter and my sort of mum crying. And it was a moment that was, I think, both like deeply kind of powerful and optimistic, because I had jumped over this huge hurdle to be able to get into one of the most competitive universities in the UK. But there was also a flip side to it as well, which is when I opened that letter, I knew my life was going to change and be upended. And even though I thought, for me personally, that is going to be really exciting, there's going to be all sorts of opportunities that come out of that, it did sort of fill me with a sense of unease as well, because I was going to dislocate myself from my friends and family. And that's how I felt at the time. It's like very excited and optimistic, but also overawed as well.
And at that time, I'm assuming you wanted to be an entrepreneur and you wanted to go into tech. So you decided to read PPE.
Yeah, it doesn't really make sense, does it, when you put it like
So
that?
tell us about that. Why did you decide to go and read PPE at Oxford?
Well, I think to kind of go into a tech career, it probably would have been more natural to do computer science. But in a lot of state schools, there isn't actually any sort of computer science resource. A lot of state schools don't have teachers who like actually know how to code. So I didn't study computer science at school, and therefore I kind of felt like I didn't have a good chance of doing that at degree level, because I was completely self-taught and independent rather than having that academic basis. So I decided to do PPE because I kind of felt like there wasn't a single subject I wanted to specialize in. So I thought the best thing for me was to kind of do three subjects in one, all of which I was interested in, which would give me a number of different toolkits to look at the world, because I felt from an entrepreneurial point of view, I mean, the thing that matters most at the start of your journey is to be that kind of all-rounder generalist who can, pick up new skills, learn new things, and do everything to kind of 80%. You don't need to be a kind of expert executor in everything, but you do need to be good enough to be able to operate across a whole suite of different things. And once you've grown in scale, then you can hire the kind of, subject matter experts who can take you to the next level. And I thought PPE was going to give me that due to doing three subjects in one. But it's funny because a lot of the other people I met there were the stereotype, and so they wanted to do PPE because they wanted to be the next prime minister. And I was somebody who was interested in politics as well. But in my mind, the best route into politics was to actually go out there and do something in the real world first. And then if you do a good job of that, maybe you can consider bringing those skills into the public realm. But I did meet a lot of students who kind of felt it was their life's destiny to do the PPE degree and then go straight into a research department or one of the political parties and climb the greasy pole from there. But that wasn't for me, to be honest.
And of the three subjects, philosophy, politics, and economics, what was your favourite?
I think economics was probably the one I was best at, but philosophy was my favourite because I'd never studied any philosophy before at school. It wasn't a subject that was offered in my state school or many state schools in the country. But what I found was great about philosophy was it just teaches you to think in a very clear way and to be able to articulate your thought process and arguments in a very kind of logical manner. I think that is a really big advantage and skill you get, not only in terms of being an entrepreneur, but sort of being in any professional environment where you have to make really high quality decisions, because you get taught to kind of avoid the kind of biases that usually creep into decision making, and you're very good at spotting like holes in a plan or a piece of logic. So I think counterintuitively, the one of those subjects is which is probably seen as the most kind of abstract, intellectual, non-practical, is probably the one that I think gave me the best ground.
And as a boy from Morley, what did you most and least like about going to Oxford?
I think what I least liked about it was a lot of the new social codes which I had to learn. Like, it wasn't just the obvious stuff, like how to use your knife and fork when you've got multiple knives and forks in front of you for like a starter, main, and dessert. And that sounds ridiculous now, but when I was 18, going to one of those like very grandiose formal dinners for the first time, like I had no idea which order to use the knife and fork in. So it wasn't just the obvious cliches like that, but it was also just like parts of my character as well. Like, I was a northerner in not just sort of heritage, but also character as well, I suppose. No straight talking, no, don't beat around the bush, say it as it is. And in many environments, that kind of way of operating isn't always received and well encouraged. And I met a lot of students at the university who didn't want to have kind of direct conversations about things. It was almost kind of like an air of diplomacy that if you aren't someone from a affluent background, it'd be quite difficult to actually understand and get your head around at the beginning. So I had to do quite a lot of adaptation and socialization. I tried to stay true to who I was, but kind of was also chameleon-like in terms of learning. Okay, I need to change a little bit in certain environments to get on. So I probably like that the least. In terms of the most, like, it was a complete sort of transformer from a kind of identity and credibility point of view. If you're someone from a low opportunity background and you get a place at one of these universities, it's transformative, not just because of the skills you learn and the people you meet and the network you build, but also because and the signaling effect from actually just having gotten into that university. And to be able to say I was a student at the University of Oxford and have that on my CV, my LinkedIn profile, like, that just opened doors for me to a world which otherwise was completely out of reach. And I don't take that for granted. I think one of the most powerful things about the top universities in this country isn't just about what they do from a kind of teaching and research point of view, but what they actually do to kind of credentialize the ambitions of their students. I think one of the reasons Oxbridge is so successful in terms of propelling people into elite positions is that kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, which is it is seen as the two elite universities in the UK. If you go there, and you have to be someone who's hardworking, conscientious, intellectual. And that perception, which is planted in the minds of the people, but also in the minds of people who go there as well, who start to believe that they are somebody who can become a mover and shaker, I think creates that self-fulfilling prophecy, which means a lot of these people do end up in elite positions. And I don't take that for granted. And that was a life changer for me that sort of put me on the right path for what I wanted to do next.
So let's talk about what you want to do next. When you were there at university, did you start to think about how you were going to spend your working career life?
Be honest, no. So for the first couple of years, I was focused on like, wow, how do I go from never having written a proper academic essay before to writing two of these every single week, the 4,000 words each? So that was my first kind of academic barrier I had to overcome. And the second was just the typical coming of age stuff, which was going to university away from home, drinking for the first time, meeting loads of people, and kind of getting my head around that social transition as well. That preoccupied most of my time. And to be honest, it wasn't until my final year of university that I started to think of these things seriously. And in retrospect, that was a little bit of a mistake from a career point of view, because what I didn't understand was how the landscape of graduate recruitment had shifted in the UK towards a system where if you don't do a piece of professional work experience in your first year, you can't get an internship in your second year. If you don't get an internship in your second year, you can't get the graduate job in your third year. And I just didn't understand that the system was set up to work like that. So I kind of naively went through university assuming that I could get a job there after I finished my exams. I can think about it at that point, not understanding that the system requires you to get on that internship train, almost from your first term of university. And I think that is something that a lot of students from low opportunity backgrounds don't understand, and it rules them out from getting the most highly selective job roles. So no, I wasn't thinking about deeply about career. Now, I had aspirations to be an entrepreneur, to do something entrepreneurial, but I didn't know what that looked like. It didn't feel like a career that was in reach. And I kind of left it to my final year of university to think more seriously about these things because I didn't know any better, to be honest.
So tell us what happened then. You graduated.
So
What
I
come?
graduated from university and I had a couple of job offers. So I had an offer to work at a Magic Circle law firm and also an offer to work in a hedge fund as well. So you kind of classic sort of professional careers that many Oxbridge graduates dream of doing. But I just knew it wasn't for me. Like the money was 4-year-old at a law firm earning £140,000 a year. That's crazy. That's like 5x the median income in the place that I grew up in at the age of 23, 24. Like crazy, crazy money. But I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I was quite shocked at how many students wanted to kind of mindlessly pursue corporate careers, which didn't necessarily align with their interests, skills, their purpose. And I thought, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to give this entrepreneurial stuff a go because if there's one point in my life where I can have a high risk tolerance, it's now because I don't really have any obligations. Now I'm a kind of single 21-year-old. I don't have kids. Like this is the time in my life that I can take a risk when later down the line, it might be too late. I might have a set of obligations that just makes it too risky an endeavor to push forward with. So I turned down my graduate job offers and got going building what became Zero Gravity. And that sounds like a romantic story now, but actually it was really, really difficult at the start of the journey because my mum like wasn't very happy that I turned down the graduate job. No, she was very supportive of my ambitions, but I think she thought I was making a big mistake because I was turning down a very stable career for something that was very, very unstable, essentially a high risk bet. My friends thought I was a sort of a little bit weird, you know, going back to my childhood bedroom in West Yorkshire to try and start a business rather than moving with them to the big smoke in London to sort of start our graduate lives. So I sort of faced a lot of social pressure not to take that decision. But as I mentioned, I thought this was the time in my life to take a big risk. And the idea which underpinned what became Zero Gravity was an idea that connected completely with my life purpose and journey, which was how do you break down barriers that stop ambitious young people from low opportunity backgrounds to getting to top universities and careers? So I felt I had to give it a go, and now was the best time.
So you've got the idea, you've lived the idea in a way. So you've got personal experience of it. You can see the need. You've lived in Morley. You've decided not to take one of these professional careers. You've gone back to Morley. You're in your bedroom. You've got a laptop, desktop. What do you do then? Do you build the website yourself? What do you do for money? Do you hire a team? How did it all start?
Yes, as I mentioned, it wasn't very romantic beginnings. Now, whilst my friends were moving down to London, they're starting their grad jobs in these beautiful glass offices and they're going to these, great places in London. I was back at home emptying the dishwasher and scrubbing the plates after dinner. And then in the evenings and during the day, that I would be in my room on my computer trying to build something from nothing. And the way I got going was I applied a lot of those skills which I learned as a teenager when I was building those mini projects. And like I said, the sort of one-man band website agency, the building some of those communities for the Football Manager game I was obsessed with. I applied those skills just to get something off the ground that worked. So for instance, like when it came to building a brand, I literally sat down and I thought, if the brand of Zero Gravity was like a Sims character, for instance, what sort of person would it be? Forget about the logo, forget about the color scheme and typeface. What is the character I want this brand to embody? What sort of person is it? Is it a kind of optimistic person or is it an angry person? I just sort of sat down and sort of agreed answers to those sort of questions. And that made it much easier to build a brand because right from the beginning, I had a real clear characterization of what I wanted to build and the brand I wanted to embody. And that made sort of getting a logo, color scheme, typeface easy because once you know who you are, it's kind of easier to know what sort of clothes to wear. So I think that's how I sort of got the brand off the ground. And when it came to the technology, I knew that I couldn't build a kind of world-beating online platform overnight. I didn't have the resources to do that. So I just kind of thought, what can I do as a one-man band at this point, which is going to kind of validate the concept that I've got? And the concept I had was essentially that you can build technology that substantially increases the chances of people from low opportunity backgrounds getting into top universities and careers. And the way I validated that is I decided as the kind of first step to just build a platform that would identify talented students from low opportunity backgrounds and get them into Oxbridge. And the reason I focused on Oxbridge was I knew that ecosystem really well. Now I'd been through that journey myself. I'd been at those universities for the past 3 years. And from a tactical point of view, I knew that was a huge media obsession with Oxbridge. I thought if I can prove this idea here, I'm going to get enough momentum to then take it elsewhere. So that's why I focused on those two universities. So it was almost like a pilot. I sort of had this big picture vision, but just focused originally on one particular slice of it and tried to pilot a concept which worked. And when it came to actually launching that technology into the world, in the beginning, I literally just posted on my own personal Facebook page. I sort of created a really basic marketing video, which explains, what I was doing, the kind of why, the how, the what. Posted it on my own personal Facebook and just got my friends to share it. And from that, I got some original viral traction, which then sort of created a domino effect of like schools finding out about it, other students, PR. So you don't have to have the kind of most grand launch plan in the world. Focus on building that minimum viable product. and just get it into the hands of users as quickly as possible. And that can literally start from your own social media pages.
And of course, there are two sides to the equation, aren't there? You've got on the one hand the users that you've got in that way, but how about the big corporates who've now come on board? How did you get them involved?
So I kind of calculated at the beginning of my journey that I didn't have enough credibility to partner with institutions. I spoke to a few schools and universities. I could just very quickly see that there was just a very strong risk aversion to working with a startup led by a kind of 21-year-old who looked like he just sort of come out of a classroom. And I could talk about the brilliance of our kind of algorithms and digital platform as much as I wanted, but there was just a fundamental lack of kind of trust that comes from being in an early stage startup where you don't have the kind of markers of credibility. Yeah. So I calculated that if I spent loads of time speaking to schools, to universities, and employers, I'm not going to get anywhere very fast. So for the first like year and a half, I just focused on building the product and getting it into the hands of as many users as possible. If anything, I tried to disintermediate the school and university system and worked around them rather than working with them. So like when it came to signing up students, rather than going through schools, it was social media led marketing, a B2C brand, they're going through B2C channels directly to students through their mobile phones rather than through their schools. And the same with universities as well. Now, we signed up the thousands of undergraduates at Oxford and Cambridge University to mentor on the platform. All of that was done without any formal support from university, just by going direct to students. So I think this is where you have to think strategically as an entrepreneur, which is even if you want to build what becomes a B2B business where you're working with some of these enterprise customers, it's not always within scope to actually get those big boys to partner with you at the beginning. So you have to find a different way to get those kind of credibility markers and the proof of concept before you actually land the business model. So the first 18 months, we had no formal partnerships whatsoever with any schools, universities, or employers. And then that's dramatically changed nowadays. And we work with many of the biggest employers in the country, HSBC, KPMG, Snapchat, Morgan Stanley, you name it. There's schools as well. We've got almost 40% of all the state schools in the UK are formally partnered with Zero Gravity. I've connected our tech into their systems. But that took, 5 years to get to that point. And that was far from an overnight success. So if you're building a B2B business, don't assume that you can conquer the world overnight. Like you have to be hyper realistic about what you can achieve with these institutions. And often they're just not set up from a kind of risk tolerance point of view to work with early stage startups. And you've got to accept that and find a way to get around it.
And so, Joe, what comes next? What's next for the platform? What's next for you? What do you want to do?
So that the first kind of 12 months of Zero Gravity, it was a bedroom startup. I was a one-man band. And then due to the success we had with the original concept of getting students into Oxbridge, I was able to expand the platform, build a team, and they start partnering with all these organizations and deliver a commercial service to boost social mobility in employers' universities that made us a revenue-generating business. So it's been a kind of whirlwind going from a kind of student bedroom to now a business that employs 27 people and supported over 8,000 students into university. But that is not the extent of the ambition. I want Zero Gravity to be the platform that makes it possible for if you're a 16-year-old living in a small town in the UK, you know this is the go-to place to not just get into that top university, but into that top career as well. And what that means is scaling to help hundreds of thousands of students, and not the kind of tens of thousands that we currently are. So it's a journey of scaling the reach and engagement, but also one of the scope as well. Now we spent the first couple of years just focusing on getting students into university. Now a huge part of what we do is actually how do you get someone into that graduate job, and how do you actually make sure they succeed once they get into a career? So we haven't just scaled the numbers of students, we've increased the kind of length of the journey in which we spend with them. And look, if we can prove this works in the UK, like why can't we expand this to other countries as well? And the social mobility is a massive problem in pretty much every single the developed economy. The UK is particularly bad in the OECD, but the US is even worse. Now, the idea of the American dream, even though it's well believed, there's scant evidence for it actually being the case. I think all big countries need to really focus on solving this issue. And I don't see this as a kind of charitable endeavor either. I see this as the big economic problem for the Western world, which is how do we utilize talent from all parts of society? Because if we don't get this right in the West, other countries are going to get this right. And that could lead to, big changes moving forward.
Well, yours is a really inspiring story, Joe, of what you've achieved to date. And rightly, you've been lauded for what you've done. But also, it's fantastic to hear about your ambitions for the future to extend the platform in terms of what you're offering people, but also your global ambitions to make the world a better place. Joe, many congratulations, and thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Cheers, really appreciate it.
To listen to more episodes and find out how to get happy in your working life, head to workall.co. Work happier.